her body. But you know, Lindsay, there are drugs that leave the system quickly. If you're not on it fast and not looking specifically for that drug, you may not find a trace of it. I can't put on the death certificate that I'm 100% certain that Lois Sprague was murdered, but in my opinion, it's the only possible cause of death. Remember I told you I'd seen something like this 2 months ago? Presumed heart attack? I chased down the death certificate and morgue photos of Anthony George, cab driver, white, 55 years old, probable cause of death, cardiac arrest. Dr. G did the post, and the heart was healthy, but no one insisted on further investigation, and the puncture mark just seemed irrelevant. Look at the death certificate. Here. Manner of death, undetermined. Claire opened a second folder, took out a photo of the hind section of Mr. George, the dead cab driver, and placed it beside a matching image of Ms. Sprague's derriere. The puncture wounds and bruises looked the same, and both were located in an awkward place for a person to inject themselves. So that's two dead people, possibly killed the same way and with no known relationship to each other, said Claire. I'm going to take a wild guess and say that someone is on a random victim killing spree, and that victim number three is coming to a morgue near us real soon. My phone vibrated and buzzed. It was Conklin. He said,
Clapper just called. The divers pulled something out of the bay not far from the piers. It's a large fire extinguisher with the ends blown off. Clapper says it may be what's left of the bomb.
Chapter 27. Claire walked me out to the front door of her offices and asked me, okay if I come with you to see Joe this evening? Sure, yes, of course. Yuki and Cindy want to see him too. Claire, he's non-responsive. We're coming, okay? We all met up in the lobby after work, and I drove us to the hospital, my car filled with my girlfriends and a whole lot of flowers. The light was dimmed in Joe's private room, and he was asleep, looking like he'd played chicken with a locomotive and lost. As my friends spoke encouraging words to my husband, I scrutinized his face. He showed no sign of hearing them. He just breathed in and out, while the vital signs monitor registered the rhythmic beating of his heart. The girls each patted his good arm, and I put my hand on his, and after a while we said goodbye and headed down to the cafeteria. We made hasty selections from the assorted hot trays and salad bars, and Cindy grabbed a booth for four. Normally it's kind of a party when the four of us meet for a meal. But not today. The bombing disaster had nearly crushed San Francisco, and it also hit home. I asked Claire for her professional opinion of Joe's condition. She reached across the table and took my hands. She said,
The shunts are out.
He's not in a coma anymore. He's in a stupor. He's healing.
He has spoken since the accident. His memory may be jumbled, but that he spoke makes me think he's doing a little better than could be expected.
The cafeteria was loud at dinner time. The PA system crackled and squealed. Trays clashed in bins, and loud conversation burst from folks gathered at the small tables. Cindy asked what I'm sure everyone was thinking.
Lens, can you talk about the science teacher? Off the record, or on?
It's a long-standing joke that Cindy has to be warned and muzzled when we're talking shop. She's a crime reporter who has broken murder cases using grit, tenacity, and insight. Of course, we all love those qualities in her, but still. Reporters report, right? If we don't say off the record, it's our own fault if something said at the table appears on the Chronicle's front page. Off the record, Cindy, I said over the din. If Conklin didn't tell you, Grant compiled a book-length manuscript on bomb-making 101, and one of the bombs he describes is a compression bomb. That's probably what was used in Cytron. Three asked as one, What's a compression bomb? I said, As I understand it, you fill a metal container with gas and a chemical that makes oxygen. You attach a detonator and maybe a timer, and when the gas ignites, the explosion changes the atmospheric pressure of, say, Cytron, and that's what blows up the structure. It's called a hard force explosion. The second blast may have been C4, also triggered by a timer on a detonator. The pieces of that second bomb may never be found, but a fire extinguisher with the ends blown off has been dredged out of the bay.
No prints on it, of course.
It's better than nothing,
Yuki said.
Grant describes a similar bomb in his manuscript, and he made a few drawings. Plus, we have the remains of the exploded bomb. Too bad he didn't take a selfie of himself planting it in Cytron.
Cindy asked,
So he just brought it in and left it there? How?
Don't know, I told her. Maybe he came to the museum disguised in a service uniform, like he was there to replace the old fire extinguisher. Maybe he came in as a science teacher. There's an idea. He could have used his real ID to get in and inserted the canister into an exhibit. At the same time, he slapped up a glob of C4 anywhere. It's a plausible theory. I went on, telling my girls that Grant's laptop had finally given in to our CSI, but what they found wasn't illegal or even incriminating. Yes, he did research on bombs. Also, nanotechnology, astronomy, the Dead Sea Scrolls, and the entertainment section of the Chronicle. Forensics also went through his phone, read his texts, chased down his frequently called phone numbers. We've got names, school administrators, takeout pizza, utility companies. There were absolutely no calls to Syria or Pakistan or Brussels, or they were untraceable. No calls to known criminals either, I said. Needless to say, we also have no hits on his fingerprints or DNA in criminal databases.
The guy is a closed book, said Cindy.
A ghost, said Claire. Or a wraith.
A very dangerous person, said Yuki.
I asked, so why did he leave that manuscript in his lab? Just an oversight? Maybe it was his joke on law enforcement, said Claire. A fake lead to make this even more exciting for him. I nodded. That feels right, Claire. He's definitely screwing with us. I know I looked defeated, and right then I felt that way. I said, Cindy, you can't quote me on any of this, but I'll get you a one-on-one phoner with Jacoby.
Excellent. Thanks, Linz.
I owe you, I said. Cindy asked Yuki,
You have enough to make a case against Grant?
Yuki said,
Right now, all we have is circumstantial evidence, but if Joe remembers what Grant said, that could be a clincher. Either way, I'm going to have to convince 12 men and women that mild-mannered science teacher built a bomb capable of leveling a 75,000-square-foot building, and that he set that bomb, ignited it, witnessed it, and left not a trace.
Part 2 Chapter 28 Yuki felt the tension spanning Courtroom 2A from corner to corner as Connor Grant's trial was about to begin. The jury had been seated, and Judge Philip R. Hoffman had taken the bench where, flanked by Old Glory and the California state flag, he had instructed the jury. The 8 men and 4 women and their alternates in the jury box looked expectant and dead serious. This was a trial of a lifetime, and they knew it. Hoffman was in his mid-50s, had thick hair and glasses, was well known in San Francisco for presiding over high-profile cases, notably the trial of a teenage girl who had returned from college on spring break and gunned down her family of 6. Yuki had history with Phil Hoffman. She had gone up against him in 2 trials when he was a criminal defense attorney. She'd lost to him the first time, beat him the next, and in both cases thought Hoffman was a gentleman. And she admired his taut, no-frills style. As a judge, he was fair, and he didn't stand for what he called funny business. Yuki had had moments of regret about leaving the defense league, but today, sitting beside Len Parisi at the prosecution table, she felt fully satisfied with her decision. The opportunity to lock up Connor Grant was monumental. If ever there was a case for the death penalty, this was it. She and Len had discussed every aspect of the case, the strengths and weaknesses, and now Len was very still, no doubt silently rehearsing his opening. Yuki used the pre-trial moments to steady her nerves with an affirmation.
You're prepared. Len's the best. The case is solid. Trust the jury.
Repeat. Yuki shot a quick glance across the aisle to the defense table, where opposition counsel Elise Antonelli sat with her unfathomable client, Connor Grant. She and Grant were speaking together behind their hands. Yuki read conflict in their expressions, but their voices never rose above a whisper.
The gallery, the rows of seats behind the bar, was full. The victims' families, survivors of the blast, and reporters waited expectantly for the trial to start. At the bench, Judge Hoffman repositioned his glasses, spoke to the court reporter and then to the bailiff, who read the charges against Connor Grant and called the court into session. Hoffman looked to the prosecution table and said,
Mr. Parisi, are the people ready?
Yes, Your Honor.
Then let's proceed with opening statements.
Red Dog Parisi got slowly to his feet. He was 6'4", 300 pounds, more or less. His skin was acne-scarred and he had coarse, rust-colored hair. He wore a black suit, white shirt, and red tie. He'd once been described as looking like a cross between a Yeti and a superpower Avenger. When this large, homely man said that he was doing the people's work, it felt good to have him on your side. Parisi lumbered out to the well of the courtroom and fixed his eyes on the jury. Their eyes were also fixed on him. Chapter 29. Parisi walked to the podium that had been set up in the well, halfway between the bench and the jury box, and addressed the court.
Your Honor, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, it's been a while since I've personally tried a case. In my job as District Attorney of San Francisco County, I am responsible for over 100 attorneys and ADAs in my office, and I oversee dozens of cases and trials. So, why am I standing before you today? Because Connor Grant, the smiling man in the cheerful blue sports coat sitting at the defense table, is a mass murderer who deliberately, with malice aforethought and considerable skill, destroyed Cytron, a science museum on Pier 15. In so doing, he killed 25 of the people who were inside.
Yuki felt a thrill as she heard Len's voice. He was keeping his anger to a slow burn. The jurors could hear the fury. They could feel the heat. Parisi went on.
Those 25 people, in fact all of the people who happened to be inside the museum that day, were of no interest to Mr. Grant. He never even thought about them. Mr. Grant simply wanted to blow the museum into billions of little pieces, and the living people were, as far as we can tell from Mr. Grant, utterly inconsequential.
Yuki watched the jurors, who had fixed their attention on Len. He swept his gaze across the length of the box, looking at each one, before he picked up the thread of his opening.
Ladies and gentlemen, among the 25 deceased are three firefighters, three selfless men who were caught in the secondary blast. Some 50 other people were injured, maimed, traumatized. And then there are all of the unnamed friends and families of the victims, hundreds of people who are grieving, emotionally damaged, who will never be the same again. During the course of this trial, you will hear that Connor Grant confessed to the police that he had blown up Cytron, even as the aftershock of the bomb reverberated in the air and the sirens and the screams echoed along the Embarcadero. Later, when Mr. Grant realized that he had trapped himself and that he was going to be tried for this terrible crime, he recanted his confession. Too late. We will present witness testimony that Mr. Grant proudly admitted to perpetrating this conscienceless attack. He was bragging. He was self-congratulatory.
Parisi shook his head, conveying his disgust with the defendant's actions. Yuki, having gone over his opening remarks with him, knew he was about to lay down the foundation of their case. He said,
But even if Mr. Grant hadn't confessed, the proof against him is overwhelming. As you will learn during this trial, he had not only the means, but the motive and the opportunity to blow up Cytron. Did Connor Grant have the means to make a bomb of sufficient size and force to blow up this large glass and steel building? Yes, he did. We will show you that Mr. Grant, a science teacher, had an unusual degree of interest in explosives and all of the tools necessary to blow up anything.
We will show you photos of the bomb-making laboratory in the defendant's garage and his book in progress that describes in detail how to build bombs of all types with ingredients easily obtained in your local pharmacy and hardware store. He even described how to create the type of bomb that was used to take down Citron. He had the knowledge and the tools. Did Connor Grant have the opportunity to place this bomb and detonate it? Yes, he did. The museum was open 7 days a week. He had a membership card, frequented this museum, and is familiar to many of the people who worked there. He could easily have brought in the bomb, which was disguised as a fire extinguisher, and armed it without alarming anyone. And after he left the building, the sight of a fire extinguisher wouldn't alert anyone to its real purpose. As to motive, Parisi went on, that is complicated.
Yuki watched Len pause, reload, and fire.
You do not have to buy into Mr. Grant's motive in order to convict him. But in the face of all this death, destruction, and traumatic injury, we do want to understand why this defendant did what he did. And he told us. Here's why Connor Grant blew Citron into smithereens. Because he wanted to do it. And we will prove to you that he could, and that he did. At the end of this trial, we will ask you, the jury, to find the defendant guilty of murder in the second degree in the deaths of 25 innocent people, to guarantee that this man,
Len pointed at Connor Grant,
can never harm anyone ever again.
Len thanked the jury, and if Yuki could have applauded him, she would have done so. Instead, she scrawled on her notepad,
"Great job, Len. Tremendous."
Chapter 30. Judge Hoffman peered over his bench and exchanged a few words with the bailiff as Len Parisi returned to the prosecution table. Then he looked across his courtroom at attorney Elise Antonelli, who was seated at the defense table beside her client, Connor Grant. Hoffman said,
"Ms. Antonelli, are you ready with your opening statement?"
Elise Antonelli stood and said, "Sidebar, Your Honor." Yuki almost said, "What?" What was defense counsel up to? Hoffman signaled to the lawyers to approach, and the three of them walked across the well to the bench.
"What is it, Ms. Antonelli?"
said Hoffman.
"I can't wait to hear."
Antonelli said, "Mr. Grant just fired me. He says that he wants to represent himself." Hoffman said,
"Fired you? Okay, step back."
Then to the jurors he said,
"I'm calling a 10-minute recess. Sit tight."
The court officers, guns on their hips, grouped behind the defendant. The judge opened the door behind the bench, and prosecution and defense counsel followed him down the corridor and assembled in his book-lined office. Parisi and Yuki took the brick-red love seat, and Elise Antonelli sat in the chair across from Hoffman's desk. Hoffman asked Antonelli,
"Why did he dismiss you? What did he give as a reason?"
Antonelli said,
"Paraphrasing now, he said, 'I'm sure you're very good, Elise, but I'm the best person to take my case to the jury.'"
"Really?"
the judge said.
"While facing 25 counts of murder, too? What took your client so long to arrive at this staggeringly stupid decision?"
"He never mentioned that he was thinking about this, Judge, until I brought him his wardrobe this morning. I guess he got some jailhouse advice, or maybe he thinks if he defends himself and he loses, he gets a mistrial on the grounds that he's got incompetent counsel."
"Is he delusional?"
Parisi asked.
Hoffman said, "Elise, don't answer that. Well, let me ask you, Len. You want to go back to the table, try to negotiate a deal with the defendant?" "Judge, I'm not opposed to his confession in open court in exchange for 25 life sentences served concurrently rather than consecutively with no possibility of parole. I offered this previously and was turned down."
Elise Antonelli leaned forward in her seat. She said,
"Judge, he won't take a deal. He wants a trial and he believes that he can win. He plans to walk free. That's what he said. That and that he has a constitutional right for a pro se defense."
Yuki recalled only three mass murderers who had defended themselves. Ted Bundy was found guilty and had been executed. Colin Ferguson, also found guilty, was given 6 life sentences. Only Lee Anthony Evans had defended himself successfully against multiple homicide charges. Connor Grant's odds of winning were better if Antonelli defended him, and that would be better for the prosecution as well. Yuki knew that a pro se defendant was a prosecutor's worst nightmare. Juries tended to feel sorry for them because they were inexperienced. Accordingly, they got away with mistakes, misstatements, and meritless objections. Whether these missteps were calculated or not, they could influence the jury in the defendant's favor. Hoffman said to Antonelli,
"Oh boy, I'll talk with him, alone, and see if I can get him to change his mind."
Chapter 31. Yuki and Len went upstairs to Len's office and tried to figure out what Connor Grant was trying to pull. Whatever it was, Judge Hoffman clearly wasn't going to tolerate it. Right? Yuki fired off a text to her husband, Homicide Lieutenant Jackson Brady, telling him in a few words the twist of events.
"Grant wants to defend himself. Says he's best person for the job."
Brady texted back,
"Huge ego. No legal experience. Good for the White Hats."
Yuki hoped Brady was right. Courtroom 2A was still empty when the prosecution team returned to their table. Moments later, Elise Antonelli came in through the side door with the defendant. Grant wore a very pleased expression and a different jacket. Apparently, Len's remarks about a cheerful blue sports coat had prompted his attorney to quickly find him a more subdued replacement. The bailiff opened the door for the 12 jurors and 4 alternates who filed in and got settled, putting handbags under seats, coughing politely, crossing legs, and exchanging questioning looks when they realized that the gallery was empty. They stood when the judge returned and took the bench, then sat again as he addressed the jurors, saying,
"Ladies and gentlemen, there has been a change to the proceedings that I'm going to tell you about right now. We can deal with any questions before the public comes in."
Yuki said softly,
"Uh-oh."
Hoffman said,
"Here's the story. The defendant, Mr. Grant, is exercising his legal right to defend himself."
There was a gasp from some of the jurors, and Yuki felt her heart speed up. She had really thought the judge would convince Grant that he was going to hurt his chances by becoming his own counsel. Hoffman explained that every defendant had a right to a pro se defense, that pro se meant on one's own behalf. He told the jurors that he had questioned Mr. Grant, and that he was convinced that the defendant could do an adequate job of presenting his case to the jury. The judge went on,
"Ms. Antonelli is acting as Mr. Grant's standby counsel. She is well-versed in this case and will guide Mr. Grant on points of law. Mr. Grant has assured me that he is of sound mind, that he understands what is at stake, and that he will not be given any breaks because of his lack of legal experience. Accordingly, the prosecution will treat Mr. Grant as opposing counsel. As for me, I'm going to make sure that this trial stays on track and that you receive the information you need to decide Mr. Grant's guilt or innocence. Are there any questions?"
Mrs. Shoemaker, a retired librarian, raised her hand.
"Is there time for me to use the restroom?"
"Yes. Anyone else? No? Bailiff, please escort juror number 4 to the jury room. Any other questions?"
There were none. When Mrs. Shoemaker returned to her seat, the judge asked the court officers to open the front doors. The gallery was filled noisily as people jostled for seats. Once the attendees were reasonably quiet, court officers formed a line at the back of the room, blocking the doors. Judge Hoffman reprised the explanation that he had given to the jury and announced that court was now in session. He said to the defendant,
"Mr. Grant, if you're ready, please make your opening statement."
Chapter 32. Grant placed a stack of note cards on the lectern and looked across the room toward the jury. He seemed utterly relaxed, appearing to Yuki every bit the schoolteacher in front of his class. When he spoke, his voice was clear and confident.
"Folks, I'm shocked to be in this courtroom. I've been charged with killing 25 people, and I had absolutely nothing to do with that terrible tragedy."
You deserve to hear exactly what happened, and I'm going to tell you. On the evening of August 3rd, I was walking northwest on the Embarcadero and was only a block or so away from Cytron when it blew the hell up.
He threw his hands into the air by way of description.
I was stunned, caught completely by surprise. I stood on the sidewalk, a bystander, an accidental witness to this enormous and violent explosion. I was dazed by the sound and the sight of what you have probably seen on television. Only I was right there while it was happening. I should introduce myself. My name is Connor Grant, and I am a science teacher. I have been a science teacher since graduating from the University of Miami in 93, and have been with St. Brendan High School for 5 years now, teaching ninth grade science. I often go to Cytron. I've taken my classes there. It was a beautiful place, and my students and I have always found it inspirational to see the exhibits, hear the lectures, and talk to other teachers and guests. As I said, on the evening of August 3rd, I was walking along the sidewalk in the direction of Cytron. Thursday night was adults only, and I wanted to stand in the observatory gallery at sunset. That's all that was in my mind. Then the shocking explosion seemed to break the sky. Glass went flying, and I saw a mushroom cloud forming over the bay. The concussion of the blast seemed to make time stand still. It was like my shoes were bonded to that pavement when the bomb went off. Imagine being so close to a bomb that the sidewalk is shimmying under your feet.
The glow on Grant's face was riveting. He had brought the destruction of Cytron right into the courtroom. He was there. And even Yuki couldn't look away. Hoffman said,
"Mr. Grant, please go on."
"Sorry, Your Honor."
Grant focused intently on the jurors, saying to them,
"At some point I became aware of the screaming. People were running from the pier where the museum had been standing, and still I could not move. This was living science, and I was trying to understand what looked like spontaneous combustion. Mr. Parisi has told you that I confessed to blowing up Cytron to a police officer." "I did no such thing. Did I comment on the explosion? Did I say that it was amazing or something? I do not know. I was in a state of shock. I was also a witness. I hope you understand that within those first moments after the blast, I wasn't thinking about people or panic or death. As a scientist with a laboratory mentality, I was mesmerized by what I had seen in the wild, and I was analyzing it too, trying to figure out exactly what had occurred in front of my eyes."
Yuki scanned the jurors' faces. They too looked mesmerized. Parisi was leaning back in his seat, watching, no doubt learning from the defendant and making a plan. Grant shuffled through his note cards, examined a couple of them. He seemed to be collecting his thoughts. A moment later, he again addressed the jury.
"Ladies and gentlemen, the prosecution will tell you that the police discovered a science lab in my garage. That is correct, although neither the garage nor the lab was hidden. My garage is in plain sight. I do experiments in my lab, not in my house. I think that makes good sense. The police will tell you that they have found a book on explosives that I have been working on for years. That's true, but it's very boring, and I don't think it will ever be published because it's not newsworthy. It's a notebook. That's how I think of it. So I have a lab that takes up half of a two-car garage and a collection of notes, but more to the point, there is no way the people can connect me to this explosion. I did not go into the museum the night of the explosion, and no one claims otherwise. Whatever took down Cytron was a perfectly distributed blast, a highly professional job. If I had been asked to detonate that building, I couldn't have done it. The skill involved is just way beyond my abilities, and that is a fact. Here's the prosecution's total case. I may have said something to a police officer when I wasn't thinking clearly. And to that I might add that this police officer may not have been thinking clearly either. I'd ask you to give everyone involved the benefit of the doubt. We were deafened by the blast, shaken up by it, and frightened almost to death. We'll never know how or why this misunderstanding between me and the police officer took place, because no record was made of any so-called admission. If I had been taken to the hospital, doctors would have said that my hearing had been affected or that I was in shock. But I was thrown into a squad car and brought into a police station where I was locked up overnight in a cell full of dangerous strangers. The next morning, after a sleepless night, I was interrogated without benefit of counsel. Days later, I was charged and held without bond. Think of that, said the science teacher. The police had me in custody, an innocent man, a victim of circumstances, and because they had no evidence at the time that this tragedy was caused by a terrorist group, they never looked any further than me, although apparently Gar has taken credit. So the prosecution has me and no one else. That's why they are desperate to pin the tail on the donkey. Me. Because it's better than having no donkey at all. Here's the simple, honest truth, Connor Grant said to the rapt jurors. Something or someone blew up Citron. But I give you my word. I swear on the Bible. I didn't do it.
Grant returned to the defense table. Yuki lowered her eyes and made notes on her tablet so that no one, not the defendant and not, God forbid, the jury, could see how amazed she was by Connor Grant's opening remarks. He'd been unbelievably articulate. He hadn't whiffed a line. And he'd come across as truthful and sincere, with just the right amount of indignation, so much so that Yuki could see on the jurors' faces that they were identifying with him. And she was questioning her own certainty that he had bombed Citron. She canceled the thought as she heard Parisi say to the judge,
"The people call Sergeant Lindsay Boxer."
Chapter 33. The influx of media was creating dangerous traffic conditions on Bryant Street. Satellite trucks from network, cable, and foreign news outlets were double-parked, blocking the grid and narrowing the lanes in front of the hall. Camera crews had set up on the sidewalk. Reporters sat in tall directors' chairs under silk shades and spoke to their viewers. Others put microphones up to the faces of anyone who would stop, and they did impromptu interviews on the Hall of Justice steps. I dodged the mob scene by using my customary route, on foot from Harriet Street, along the breezeway, and through the back door. I'd taken time to look my professional best. I wore my gray Ralph Lauren blazer and blue trousers, a man-tailored white shirt, and sturdy, polished Cole Haan flats. My blonde hair was pulled back in a pony, as usual, and I'd worn makeup for the occasion. My badge hung from a long ball chain around my neck. And I arrived ahead of time in the hallway outside courtroom 2A, where I waited to be called. The testimony I was prepared to give against Connor Grant was pretty much the heart of the prosecution's case. I wasn't nervous exactly, but I was keyed up. A lot of people were depending on me. The door to the courtroom opened and the bailiff said to me,
"Sergeant Boxer, you're up."
He held the door open and I strode into the courtroom and up the aisle, passing many people who were turning to look at me as if there were music playing Here Comes the Bride. I nodded at Yuki as I went through the gate, then continued to the witness box, where I placed my hand on the Bible and swore to tell the whole truth, so help me God. When I was seated, my dear friend Yuki approached me. She asked me a series of questions, establishing my occupation and expertise. How long I had been with the SFPD, what department, how many commendations, and if I had arrested Connor Grant on the night in question. Yuki is a fast talker, but I'm used to her pace. She snapped out the questions, and I answered without hesitation or embellishment. She said,
"Sergeant Boxer, were you working at 7:23 p.m. on August 3rd, the night of the Citron incident?"
I said, "No, I was having dinner with my husband in a restaurant on Pier 9 directly opposite Pier 15. We had a clear view of Citron." She asked me to recount the events, and I did so, starting with our window on the explosion, our departure from the restaurant, and our race to the scene a short way up the street. I said, "Crowds were fleeing the site of the bomb, running past where my husband and I were standing at the edge of the sidewalk. My husband, his name is Joe Molinari, was calling for emergency support, and I was waiting with him when I noticed a man standing stock still in the middle of the moving crowd."
"Do you see that man in the room now?"
"Yes. I saw the defendant."
"Okay.
Yuki said.
Please tell the jury what happened next.
I recalled my very vivid memories of speaking to Grant, and I repeated what I had said to him, what he had said to me. I took him to be a witness, and I asked him to tell me what he had seen. My husband was standing with me, and we both heard Mr. Grant take full and individual credit for blowing up the museum. He told me that he hadn't simply witnessed the explosion, he had created it, I told the court. He said that it was beautiful, and that he awarded himself an A-plus with extra points for the sunset.
And did you find this answer believable?
I didn't know what to think at first, so I asked him to tell me again what had happened. He again insisted that he had exploded the bomb, and he elaborated on his original statement, essentially boasting about what a beautiful work of art he had created.
What happened next, Sergeant Boxer?
I arrested Mr. Grant for destruction of public property. After I read him his rights, I brought him over to a squad car and gave one of the officers orders to take him to booking and to turn him over to Lieutenant Brady of Homicide, my CO. Yuki asked,
And how did Mr. Grant appear to you?
I said, He was lucid. He seemed to have full awareness of the events and his role in them.
Did you offer medical treatment?
I asked him how he felt. He said he was fine. Yuki asked,
What happened after that?
The squad car left, and my husband ran into what was left of Citron to see if he could help any survivors. He was hit by debris in the second blast.
Sergeant Boxer, was he injured?
Yes.
And did you interview Mr. Grant the next morning?
I did, along with Lieutenant Brady.
Can you describe that interview for the court?
Yes. The defendant was uncooperative. He denied confessing to the bombing and refused to answer further questions.
Thank you, Sergeant Boxer,
said Yuki.
Mr. Grant, your witness.
Chapter 34 Yuki watched as Grant got up from his seat and approached Lindsay. He stuck his hands into his pant pockets, giving him the insouciance of a popular college kid. Yuki found his demeanor damned creepy. Grant said,
Hello again, Sergeant Boxer. I have just a couple of questions for you, unlike the punishing drubbing I've suffered at your hands.
Yuki shot to her feet.
Objection, Your Honor.
Hoffman said,
Sustained. Mr. Grant, no personal comments to the witness. Just ask your questions. Sorry, Your Honor. Sergeant, did you see me coming out of Citron that night?
No.
Did you find any bomb implements, control devices, or anything of that nature when you frisked and cuffed me?
No.
Did you record my so-called confession when you questioned me on the sidewalk between Piers 9 and 15 that evening?
No. I didn't have to record-
No. Your answer is no. You didn't record any so-called admission. You didn't see me in the building, and you found nothing bomb-related on my person. Isn't that right?
Yes.
Your Honor, said Grant, I'm done with this witness.
Yuki saw the flash of anger in Lindsay's face and understood exactly how she felt. Furious because she had no opportunity to redress the insult. The judge asked the prosecution if they had questions on redirect, and Len said,
No, Your Honor, but we reserve the right to recall this witness.
The judge asked Lindsay to step down, and once she had left the courtroom, he made an announcement.
I'm sorry, he said. I have to attend to some important court business. I'm calling a recess. Short one. Court will resume in 1/2 hour.
Doors opened. The jury returned to their room. Some people in the gallery left their seats, and Parisi said he wanted to make some calls and he'd be back in a few. Yuki stayed at the prosecution table, made notes, and thought about Joe. His recovery had been touch and go. She and Len had worried for weeks about his ability to testify. He was still weak and visibly changed from the way Yuki had always known him. Physically strong, mentally sharp. Could he retell Grant's confession convincingly now? Yuki could only hope so. If Joe failed to corroborate Lindsay's testimony, a canyon of reasonable doubt would open in their case, and it would be almost impossible for the prosecution to bridge it. Chapter 35 After my testimony, I left the courtroom and went to the fire stairs, taking a seat on a step about midway between the second and third floors. I got a pretty good signal here, and no one using the stairway ever bothered me. I called Joe, listened to the phone ring through, counted the number of rings, hoping he would answer.
Lindsay?
Hi. How are you feeling, Joe?
Good. Pretty good.
He sounded like he wasn't sure. Where are you?
We're on 7th Street. About 5 minutes away, right, Kevin? We hit some traffic.
5 minutes away? He was cutting it very close. If Hoffman hadn't called a recess, Joe would have been a no-show, leaving Yuki and Len to tap dance for more time. I flicked that disturbing thought away. I asked, Is Kevin your driver?
That's right. You okay, Linz? It's hard to hear you.
I'm in the fire stairs. I don't want anyone to hear me. I just want to tell you I just got out of court. Grant is a beast.
Meaning what?
He cross-examined me with a scalpel. Or a chainsaw. Not sure. But it was brutal.
Yeah. Well.
Joe's voice sounded like he was floating away. Joe. Joe, can you hear me?
I can now.
Do you remember when we talked to him right after the explosion?
Sure. He said he did it.
He had a cockeyed story. I tried not to sigh loudly into the mouthpiece. A couple of people ran past me down the stairs. You still there, Joe?
Yep. We're on Bryant. I can see the hall.
I said, Is Kevin bringing you into the building? I heard Joe ask,
Kevin, you taking me inside?
Then Joe said,
It's the second floor?
Right, that's right. Court starts again in 15 minutes. The phone clicked off. I looked. I still had battery life. Joe's phone had disconnected, not mine. I went online and looked up Connor Grant on the Chronicle's website and read Cindy's update on the trial. She had written that the defendant was a pretty decent lawyer for a schoolteacher and that the witnesses for the prosecution would be questioned today. She wrote,
The prosecution called their first witness this morning, Homicide Sergeant Lindsay Boxer. Sergeant Boxer testified that Mr. Grant confessed to her at the time of the explosion that he had bombed Citron. He denied this admission in his opening statement. Earlier, D.A. Len Parisi told this reporter that he is confident that the jury will find the defendant guilty. As in all trials, the burden of proof is on the prosecution, who must convince the jury of the defendant's guilt beyond a shadow of a doubt.
As I sat in the stairwell, shadows of doubt in all colors and shapes crossed my mind. Most of them pointed to Joe. Would he remember Grant's confession? Could he stand up to Grant's cross-examination? I wouldn't even be allowed in the courtroom to see and hear him for myself. I called Yuki.
You did fine, Lindsay.
Huh. Let me know how it goes for Joe, I said.
Will do,
said Yuki. Chapter 36. The court officer opened the doors, and Yuki watched Joe Molinari enter the courtroom in a wheelchair, pushing the wheels with his hands. When he reached the witness box, the bailiff brought the Bible to him and swore him in. Joe asked for assistance. He leaned on the bailiff's arm, pulled himself to his feet and hopped a short way, then hoisted himself into the chair a step up from the floor. Yuki thought that Joe truly looked like a victim of the explosion. Not only was he unable to walk, his hair had grown back enough to highlight the terrible scars on the back of his head. She felt tears coming into her eyes as she looked at him. Parisi approached Joe and thanked him for coming to court in person, rather than being televised by closed-circuit TV. Joe said,
No problem. Glad to do it.
Len asked,
Mr. Molinari, what's your occupation?
I'm an independent security contractor.
What kind of work did you do before you went out on your own?
Joe thought for a second and then said,
I was deputy director of Homeland Security, and both before and after that, I was a senior agent with the FBI.
How would you rate your observational abilities before your recent injuries?
I would rate them as exceptional.
Joe hesitated a beat, then said,
And after my injuries, also.
You suffered brain trauma in the second blast at Citron. Isn't that right?
Correct.
Yuki waited for him to continue. His memory was fine. He was articulate. But his responses were slow. Joe said,
I've had several MRIs and a lot of testing. and my cognitive faculties are intact. Thank you, Mr. Molinari. Judge Hoffman, I wish to enter Exhibits 1 through 9, medical documentation and certification by neurologists and psychologists, that Mr. Molinari has no mental incapacity or defect as the result of his injuries.
Go ahead, said the judge. The material was entered. Joe looked over at Yuki. Their eyes met. He smiled. Parisi moved back toward Joe and asked him,
Do you remember the evening of the bomb incident on Pier 15?
Like it just happened.
Do you remember hearing the defendant, Mr. Connor Grant, describing his role in the bombing to your wife, Homicide Sergeant Lindsay Boxer?
I do.
Could you tell the court what Mr. Grant told Sergeant Boxer and yourself?
Yes. She asked him if he'd seen the explosion. He said, Did I see it? I created this magnificent event. This is my work. Sergeant Boxer asked him his name, and he told us, and he described himself as a genius, a creator of beauty. He asked if we had seen all of it. The mushroom cloud, the color of sun down on the glass. He said he gave himself extra points for that.
Parisi said,
Do you remember anything else, he said?
I do. Sergeant Boxer asked him again, Are you saying you bombed Citron? And he said, Exactly. He was emphatic. And he added that if we needed to know why, he said that beauty didn't need a reason.
Parisi asked,
Did you believe this confession?
There was a moment of silence. Yuki didn't breathe as she watched Joe disappear into his memory. And then he snapped his eyes back to Lenz.
Yes, I believed him. Mr. Grant confessed again, gave his reasons for blowing up the museum, and bragged about what a fine job he'd done, how proud he was that he had done it. He was convincing. And despite the fact that, in my opinion, what he did was crazy, he sounded sane to me.
Thanks, Mr. Molinari. Your Honor, I have no more questions for this witness.
Chapter 37. Yuki saw Connor Grant speak to Elise Antonelli from behind his hand, and after a moment, Judge Hoffman asked,
Mr. Grant, do you wish to cross-examine the witness?
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, I do.
Grant got up, crossed the room to the witness box, and said,
Mr. Molinari, first, I'm sorry that you were injured. You must still be in a lot of pain.
Joe said,
I can handle it.
Grant went on.
Do you love your wife?
Parisi yelled,
Objection, Your Honor, irrelevant and out of line because it has nothing to do with anything.
Grant said,
Goes to the veracity of his testimony, Your Honor. Overruled, Mr. Parisi. Mr. Molinari, please answer.
Yes, I love my wife,
Grant said.
So if your wife said to you, Joe, this is what Connor Grant said to me, and you actually didn't remember hearing anything, you'd be inclined to support your wife, wouldn't you?
Are you asking me if I'm lying?
Are you?
I am not.
Let me ask you this, Grant went on. Did you record my so-called admission?
No.
Did you see me run from the building?
No.
Isn't it true that my so-called confession could have been the dazed mumbling of a stunned bystander? Me? Is it possible that your wife made the confession up and you're just backing her to the hilt?
Parisi roared his objection. The judge sustained it. Parisi moved to strike the defendant's last question, and Hoffman asked the court reporter to so strike. Connor Grant apologized and said that he had no more questions. Grant looked quite smug when he returned to his seat, and Yuki understood why. He'd made his point. Then he'd drilled in on it. And he'd concluded his questioning with a simple message that Joe's corroboration was a feature of his marriage, not his memory. Joe's testimony had been terrific. Would the jury believe him? Yuki's silent mantra started up without prompting.
You're prepared. Len's the best. The case is solid. Trust the jury.
Chapter 38. Yuki, Len, and I sat around the big man's desk with our sandwiches, accompanied by the sounds of traffic whizzing by on Bryant. As a witness, I wasn't allowed inside the courtroom except to give my testimony, but Yuki filled me in on what I'd missed, crowing,
"Linz, Joe was perfect. He got it all right, and being a victim of the blast added to his credibility. I wish you could have seen him."
Yuki was pumped. Len was confident. I was bummed that Grant had chopped my testimony into pieces with four short, sharp questions.
Jeez, that's great. What a relief. And by the way, I want a do-over.
You were fine, said Red Dog. You laid it out. The jury got you. Grant's cross didn't hurt you, Lindsay.
No, I said. So why am I worried? Yuki said,
You're worried about our lack of physical evidence. Can't be helped. God knows we turned over every stone, his house, his friends, his story, the pier. Still, if there hadn't been such a public outcry, if we'd had more time, maybe we could have found something physical in that vast pile of wreckage on Pier 15.
I nodded. I understood the pressure. The bombing of Cytron had been worldwide news when it happened and was superheated now because of the trial. Reporters were ambushing court workers in the parking lot, clogging the street with their satellite trucks, calling us at all hours for quotes. Until a political or celebrity scandal or an even bigger tragedy pushed the bombing off the front page, the media would feed the beast at our expense. And there was also internal pressure to move smartly ahead and get a conviction. Parisi was up for re-election this year. So was the mayor.
You think we missed something? I asked.
Parisi's brow wrinkled and he put down his grilled cheese to answer me.
No. I don't, or I would have put the brakes on this thing. Lindsay, you know as well as we do, the city had to crash that crime scene quickly. Had to search for survivors and bodies. Had to reopen the piers and the street. Look, there's no way that nutjob committed the perfect crime. He's going away for good.
Better believe it, Yuki said.
When I'd handed Connor Grant off to the squad car in front of Pier 15 2 months before, I'd been sure we had the right guy headed for a probable slam dunk conviction. That was once upon a time, long, long ago. Parisi chucked pickles and used paper goods into the trash. He checked the time on the wall clock with the growling red bulldog graphic on its face, and then he addressed my concern again.
Lindsay, juries do what they do. Our case is good, and it's the case we have.
I know. I believed in Parisi and Yuki. I also believed in Connor Grant's shrewdness. His audacious crime reminded me of the Boston Marathon bombing, with one exception. Connor Grant didn't run and hide. It hit me for the first time. Yuki read my expression.
What is it, Lindsay?
New thought. Grant wanted to be caught. He stood there. He confessed to a cop. Maybe this trial is part of his magnificent masterwork. Len said,
Then he's going to have a lot of time in a cage to think about what he did wrong.
Chapter 39. Court resumed, and Judge Hoffman asked the people to call their next witness. Yuki called Charles Clapper, director of San Francisco's forensics lab. After Clapper had been sworn in, Yuki asked him preliminary questions: his title, the scope of his job, his background in forensics. Then she asked him to tell about the defendant's garage laboratory. Yuki asked,
Were there bomb-making materials in Mr. Grant's lab?
Yes. We found implements and chemicals that could be used to make explosives. Quarter sticks of dynamite, black powder, cardboard tubes, sealing wax, rolls of green stuff that's called rocket fuse, and chemical colorants often used for fireworks. Glass jars of BBs and nails. Assorted lengths of pipe.
Under Yuki's questioning, Clapper testified that in his opinion, the principal bomb used in the museum was a compression bomb that had been made with a gas-filled container and ignited by a detonator, either remotely or with a preset timer. He said,
It wouldn't take much exploded gas to change the pressure inside that building. That'll cause what's called a high-order explosion that will disintegrate glass, any kind of paneling. It brought the roof down,
Clapper said.
And the bowstring trusses crushed those second-story pedestrian bridges. The smaller bomb was probably C4 with a timer device, probably placed near one of the posts, supporting the center dome in order to finish off that whole house of cards.
Could that second bomb have been timed to kill fire and rescue?
Secondary blasts are often set for that purpose.
Yuki asked.
Were these two types of bombs described and illustrated in Mr. Grant's notebook?
Yes. Chapter 9 was about the use of C4 and other plastic bombs. Chapter 14 was devoted to compression bombs.
In your opinion, was Mr. Grant capable of building and setting such bombs?
In my opinion, he could have practically done it blindfolded.
Yuki asked if remains of the bombs had been found at the scene, and Clapper answered,
A fire extinguisher with both ends blown off was recovered from the bay off Pier 15. That would be the remains of a compression bomb. The C4 would have vaporized without a trace.
Yuki thanked Clapper and turned him over to the defendant. Grant stood, buttoned his jacket, and approached the witness. Yuki admired his composure. Honestly, if it weren't for his patchy shave, she could believe that he was an actual high-priced litigator.
Director Clapper, said Grant, did you find any kind of gas or gas containers in or around my house or car or lab? No.
Did you find any evidence?
A cell phone with a record of an outgoing call that can't be identified, fingerprints at the scene, records of a fire extinguisher purchase, or anything that linked me to that explosion? No. Thanks. I have no other questions for this witness.
Yuki said,
Redirect, Your Honor.
The judge said,
Go ahead, Counselor.
Yuki stepped out from the prosecution table, walked to the witness box.
Director Clapper, where could a person obtain a container for a compression bomb?
Any hardware store, home improvement store. You can get a fire extinguisher, big one, like the one that was used, for about $50. If you wanted to use a pressure cooker, every big box store in the country sells them.
And gas? Is that hard to get?
Nah. Bottled gas, natural, propane, argon, it's all available in those same kinds of outlets. The perchlorate, any chemical supply company has that.
Could you buy these implements for cash?
Sure.
So, no, there wouldn't be credit card records. And if someone wanted to plant such a bomb any time in advance of the explosion, hypothetically, would that be possible?
Yes. That building had no metal detectors. They couldn't. Exhibits were coming through the doors, being set up and changed out nonstop. Someone could have wired up the bomb, brought it into the building. Could have left a fire extinguisher anywhere it wouldn't have looked out of place, including as a swap for an active fire extinguisher. Easy enough to slap a glob of C4 onto a girder. In fact,
Clapper said,
hypothetically, if a person had a degree in science and a working knowledge of explosives, it would be ridiculously easy.
Thank you, sir. That's all.
With a stern look, the judge silenced the whispers that swept through the gallery. Then Connor Grant stood up and said to Clapper,
Just a couple more questions for you, sir. Hypothetically, you say, a person could have left a bomb in Citron. Ridiculously easy. The implication is that even you could do it, isn't that right?
Hypothetically,
Clapper said dryly.
Did you plant the bombs in that building?
No, I did not.
Well, I didn't do it either. That's all I have for you, sir.
Chapter 40. After Clapper left the stand, Yuki called Margaret Callahan, a motherly-looking 30-something woman in a peach-colored suit and tortoiseshell glasses. She told the court that she was a bank teller and had been on her way home from the Chase Bank at Embarcadero Center when she'd heard what she thought was a sonic boom and had seen the explosion of glass filling the sky. She'd taken a video with her phone. Yuki asked,
Is there anyone in this courtroom you recognize from that evening of August 3rd?
Yes, she pointed to Grant. I saw the defendant there. Yuki teed up her video presentation. Len opened the screen, adjusted it so that the jury could see, and asked the court officers to dim the lights. Yuki pressed the remote, and after the first frames appeared, Connor Grant objected, and Yuki paused the video.
Judge, this isn't fair. The video will only serve to prejudice and inflame the jury.
Yuki said, Your Honor, this video shows the scene at Citron in the immediate aftermath of the bombing. The jury needs to see the effects of this crime in order